Part 3. Transparency. Chapter 6. The Friends Fallacy. By its fifth season, Friends was well on its way to becoming one of the most successful television shows of all time. It was one of the first great hangout comedies. Six friends, Monica, Rachel, Phoebe, Joey, Chandler, and Ross, live in a chaotic jumble in downtown Manhattan. Couple and decouple, flirt and fight, but mostly just talk, endlessly and hilariously. The season begins with Ross getting married to a non-Friends outsider. By mid-season, the relationship will be over, and by season's end, he will be back in the arms of Rachel. Phoebe gives birth to triplets and takes up with a police officer. And most consequentially, Monica and Chandler fall in love, a development that creates an immediate problem because Monica is Ross's sister and Chandler is Ross's best friend, and neither of them have the courage to tell Ross what is happening. Let me cue up episode 15, titled The One with the Girl Who Hits Joey. At the beginning of episode 15, Ross looks out his window at the apartment across the way and spots his sister Monica in a romantic embrace with Chandler. He's thunderstruck. He runs to Monica's apartment and tries to barge in, but the chain is on her door, so he sticks his face into the 6-inch gap.
Chandler! 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 I saw what you were doing from the window! I saw what you were doing to my sister! Now get out of here!
Listen, we had a good run.
Chandler, alarmed, tries to escape out the window. Monica holds him back.
I can handle Ross. Hold on! Hey, Ross, what's up, bro?
Ross runs inside, lunges at Chandler, and starts to chase him around the kitchen table, shouting, "What the hell are you doing?" Chandler hides behind Monica. Joey and Rachel rush in.
Hey, what's going on?
Well, I think Ross knows about me and Monica. Right there.
I thought you were my best friend. This is my sister. My best friend and my sister. I cannot believe this.
Did you follow all that? A standard Friends season had so many twists and turns of plot and variations of narrative and emotion that it seems as though viewers would need a flow chart to make sure they didn't lose their way. In reality, however, nothing could be further from the truth. If you've ever watched an episode of Friends, you'll know that it is almost impossible to get confused. The show is crystal clear. How clear? I think you can probably follow along, even if you turn off the sound. The second of the puzzles that began this book was the bail problem. How is it that judges do a worse job of evaluating defendants than a computer program, even though judges know a lot more about defendants than the computer does? This section of Talking to Strangers is an attempt to answer that puzzle, beginning with the peculiar fact of how transparent television shows such as Friends are. To test this idea about the transparency of Friends, I call up a psychologist named Jennifer Fugate, who teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth. Fugate is an expert in FACTS, which stands for Facial Action Coding System. In FACTS, every one of the 43 distinctive muscle movements in the face is assigned a number called an action unit. People like Fugate, who are trained in FACTS, can then look at someone's facial expressions and score them, just as a musician can listen to a piece of music and translate it into a series of notes on the page. So, for example, take something called a Pan Am smile, the kind of smile a flight attendant gives you when he or she is trying to be polite. When you give that kind of smile, you pull up the corners of your lips using what's called the zygomaticus major muscle. But you leave the rest of your face impassive. That's why the smile looks fake. It's a smile without any kind of facial elaboration. In the FACTS, the Pan Am smile using the zygomaticus major is scored as action unit 12. By contrast, there's what's called a Duchenne smile. It's a genuine smile where cheeks move up and there are telltale crow's feet around the eyes. In technical terms, a Duchenne smile is action unit 12 plus action unit 6, meaning that it's a facial movement involving the outer portion of the orbicularis oculi muscle. Fax is an extraordinarily sophisticated tool. It involves cataloging in exact detail thousands of muscular movements, some of which may appear on the face for no more than a fraction of a second. The fax manual is over 500 pages long. If Fugate had done a fax analysis of the entire Girl Who Hits Joey episode, it would have taken her weeks. So I asked her to focus just on that opening scene. Ross sees Chandler and Rachel embracing, then rushes over in anger. Here's what she found. When Ross looks through the cracked door and sees his sister in a romantic embrace with his best friend, his face shows action units 10 plus 16 plus 25 plus 26. That's the upper lip raiser, the lower lip depressor, parted lips, and jaw drop. In the fax system, muscular movements are also given an intensity measure from A to E, with A being mildest and E strongest. All of Ross's four muscle movements in that moment are strong E's. If you go back and watch that Friends episode and freeze the screen at the moment when Ross looks through the doorframe, you'll see exactly what the fax coders are describing. He has an unmistakable look on his face of anger and disgust. Ross then rushes into Monica's apartment. The tension in the scene is accelerating, and so are Ross's emotions. Now his face reads 4C plus 5D plus 7C plus 10E plus 16E plus 25E plus 26E. Again, 4 E's.
That's a brow lowerer. And then a 7 is an eye squint. It's called lid tightener.
This is Fugate.
He's kind of scowling and closing his eyes at the same time. So that's a stereotypic anger. And then it's very classic for disgust, both a 9 and a 10. And then the 16 sometimes happens with that. That's a lower lip depressor. So that's when you push your bottom lip down so that you can see your bottom teeth.
In the episode, Monica tries to pretend nothing is amiss. She smiles at her brother, but it's a Pan Am smile, not a Duchenne smile. Some 12 and the barest, least plausible whisper of 6. Ross chases Chandler around the kitchen table. Chandler hides behind Monica, and as Ross approaches, he says,
"Look, we're not just messing around. I love her. Okay, I'm in love with her."
Then Monica reaches and takes Ross's hand.
"I'm so sorry that you had to find out this way. I'm sorry, but it's true. I love him too."
There's a long silence as Ross stares at the two of them, processing a storm of competing emotions. Then he bursts into a smile, hugs them both, and repeats himself, only this time happily.
"My best friend and my..."
As Monica breaks the news to her brother, Fugate scores her as 1C plus 2D plus 12D. The 1 and 2 in combination are sadness. She's raised the inner and outer parts of her eyebrows. 12D, of course, is the emotionally incomplete Pan Am smile.
She kind of gives, as strange as that sounds, is an indicator of sadness, but then happiness. And I think it kind of makes sense because she's apologizing, but then she's showing Ross, right, that she's actually okay with this.
Ross looks at his sister for a long beat. His face scores classic sadness. Then his face subtly shifts to 1E plus 12D. He's giving back to his sister the exact same mix of emotions she gave to him. Sadness combined with the beginnings of happiness. He's losing his sister, but at the same time, he wants her to know that he appreciates her joy. Fugate's fax analysis tells us that the actors in Friends make sure that every emotion, their character is supposed to feel in their heart is expressed perfectly on their face. That's why you can watch the scene with the sound turned off and still follow along. The words are what make us laugh or what explain particular nuances of narrative, but the facial expressions of the actors are what carry the plot. The actors' performances in Friends are transparent. Transparency is the idea that people's behavior and demeanor, the way they represent themselves on the outside, provides an authentic and reliable window into the way they feel on the inside. It is the second of the crucial tools we use to make sense of strangers. When we don't know someone, or can't communicate with them, or don't have the time to understand them properly, we believe we can make sense of them through their behavior and demeanor. The idea of transparency has a long history. In 1872, 13 years after first presenting his famous treatise on evolution, Charles Darwin published The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. Smiling and frowning and wrinkling our noses in disgust, he argued, were things that every human being did as a part of evolutionary adaptation. Accurately and quickly communicating our emotions to one another was of such crucial importance to the survival of the human species, he believed, that the face had developed into a kind of billboard for the heart. Darwin's idea is deeply intuitive. Children everywhere smile when they are happy, frown when they are sad, or giggle when they are amused, don't they? It isn't just people watching Friends in their living room in Cleveland, Toronto, or Sydney who can make sense of what Ross and Rachel are feeling. It's everyone. The bail hearings described in Chapter 2 are likewise an exercise in transparency. The judge does not correspond with the parties in a court case by email or call them up on the telephone. Judges believe that it's crucial to look at the people they're judging. A Muslim woman in Michigan was the plaintiff in a lawsuit a few years ago, and she came to court wearing the traditional niqab, a veil covering all but her eyes. The judge asked her to take it off. She refused. So the judge dismissed her case. He didn't think he could fairly adjudicate a disagreement between two parties when he couldn't see one of them. He told her, "One of the things that I need to do as I am listening to testimony is I need to see your face and I need to see what's going on. And unless you take that off, I can't see your face. And I can't tell whether you're telling me the truth or not. And I can't see certain things about your demeanor and temperament that I need to see in a court of law." Do you think the judge was right? I'm guessing many of you do. We wouldn't spend as much time as we do looking at people's faces if we didn't think there was something valuable to be learned. In novels, we read that his eyes widened in shock or her face fell in disappointment, and we accept without question that faces really do fall and eyes really do widen in response to the feelings of shock and disappointment. We can watch Ross and know what he feels with the sound off, because thousands of years of evolution have attuned us to expressions human beings make. We believe someone's demeanor is a window into their soul. But that takes us back to puzzle number two. Judges in bail hearings have a window into the defendant's soul, yet they are much worse at predicting who will reoffend than John Kleinberg's computer, which has a window into no one's soul. If real life were like Friends, judges would beat computers, but they don't. So maybe real life isn't like Friends. The Trobriand Islands lie 100 miles east of Papua New Guinea, in the middle of the Solomon Sea. The Trobriand Archipelago is tiny, home to 40,000 people. It's isolated and tropical. The people there fish and farm much as their ancestors did thousands of years ago, and their ancient customs have proven remarkably durable, even in the face of the inevitable encroachments of the 21st century. In the same way that car makers take new models to the Arctic to test them under the most extreme conditions possible, social scientists sometimes like to stress test hypotheses in places such as the Trobriands. If something works in London or New York and it works in the Trobriands, you could be pretty sure you're onto something universal, which is what sent two Spanish social scientists to the Trobriand Islands in 2013. Sergio Jaramillo is an anthropologist. He had worked in the Trobriands before, and he knew the language and culture. Carlos Crivelli is a psychologist. He had spent the earliest part of his career testing the limits of transparency. Once, he examined dozens of videotapes of judo fighters who had just won their matches to figure out when exactly they smiled. Was it at the moment of victory, or did they win, then smile? Another time, he watched videos of people masturbating to find out what their faces looked like at the moment of climax. Presumably, an orgasm is a moment of true happiness. Is that happiness evident and observable in the moment? In both cases, it wasn't, which didn't make sense if our emotions are really a billboard for the heart. These studies made Crivelli a skeptic, so he and Jaramillo decided to put Darwin to the test. Jaramillo and Crivelli started with 6 headshots of people looking happy, sad, angry, scared, and disgusted, with one final picture of someone with a neutral expression. Before they left for the Trobriands, the two men took their pictures to a primary school in Madrid and tried them out on a group of children. They put all 6 photos before a child and asked, "Which of these is the sad face?" Then they went to the second child and asked, "Which of these is the angry face?" And so on, cycling through all 6 pictures over and over again. The children had no difficulty at all with the exercise. Then Jaramillo and Crivelli flew to the Trobriand Islands and repeated the process. The Trobrianders were friendly and cooperative. They had a rich, nuanced language, which made them an ideal test case for a study of emotion. Jaramillo explained it to me at a cafe, where I met with him and Crivelli to discuss their study.
Sometimes, so to say that something has really surprised you in a positive way, they say it has enraptured my mind, or it has cut my mind. So, you know, so when you say, you know, when you repeat that, you say, well, has this thing cut your mind? It's like, well, no, this one is more like it has taken my stomach away.
People with phrases like, it's taken my stomach away, are not people who would be flummoxed by being asked to make sense of emotional truth. If Darwin was correct, the Trobrianders should be as good as the school children in Madrid at making sense of people's faces. Emotions are hardwired by evolution. That means people in the middle of the Solomon Sea must have the same operating system as people in Madrid. Right? Wrong. The Trobrianders struggled. All of the 113 school children identified the happiness face as a happiness face, but only 58% of the Trobrianders did, while 23% looked at a smiling face and called it neutral. And happiness is the emotion where there is the most agreement between the Trobrianders and the Spanish children. On everything else, the Trobrianders' idea of what emotion looks like on the outside appears to be totally different from our own.
I think that probably the thing that surprises the most is the fact that, you know, what we think in Western societies is a phase of a fear of somebody who's scared. It's a gasping phase. Turns out that, you know, like, is recognized in the Trobriand as more as a threat. In our culture, my face would be like, I'm scared. I'm scared of you. In their culture, that face is not the face of somebody who's scared, but it's the face of somebody who's trying to scare somebody else.
It's somebody that is not scared, is threatening.
Or threatening.
Here, Crivelli mimed the gasping face, wide open eyes, the face from Edvard Munch's famous painting, The Scream. The sensation of fear for a Trobriand Islander is not any different from the fear that you or I feel. They get the same sick feeling in the pit of their stomach, but for some reason they don't show it in the same way we do. Anger was just as bad. You would think, wouldn't you, that everyone in the world would know what an angry face looks like. It's such a fundamental emotion. the hard eyes, the tight mouth. But anger baffled the Chobianders. When looking at what Madrid schoolchildren knew as the angry face, 20% of Chobianders called it a happy face. 17% called it a sad face. 30% called it a fearful face. 20% thought it was a sign of disgust, and only 7% identified it the way that nearly every Spanish schoolchild had.
You know, like they're frowning, or they use one of these big Ibacala, you know, like proverbs that say, like, you know, like means like his brow is dark, which obviously can translate as he's frowning, you know. But they wouldn't infer that that means that this person is angry
all the time.
To make sure the Chobianders weren't some kind of special case, Jaurillo and Crivelli then traveled to Mozambique to study a group of isolated fishermen known as the Mwani. Once again, the results were dismal. The Mwani did marginally better than chance with the smiling faces, but they seemed baffled by sad faces and angry faces. Another group, led by Maria Gendron, traveled to the mountains of northwest Namibia to see whether the people there could accurately sort photographs into piles according to the emotional expression of the subject. They couldn't. Even historians have now gotten into the act. If you could go into a time machine and show the ancient Greeks and Romans pictures of modern-day people grinning broadly, would they interpret that expression the same way we do? Probably not. As classicist Mary Beard writes in her book, Laughter in Ancient Rome, this is not to say that Romans never curled up the edges of their mouths in a formation that would look to us much like a smile. Of course they did. But such curling did not mean very much in the range of significant social and cultural gestures in Rome. Conversely, other gestures, which would mean little to us, were much more heavily freighted with significance. If you staged a screening of that Friends episode for the Trobriand Islanders, they would see Ross confronting Chandler and think Chandler was angry and Ross was scared. They would get the scene completely wrong. And if you threw a Friends premiere in ancient Rome for Cicero and the Emperor and a bunch of their friends, they would look at the extravagant grimaces and contortions on the faces of the actors and think, what on earth? Okay, what about within a culture? If we limit ourselves to the developed world and forget about outliers and ancient Rome, do the rules of transparency now work? No, they don't. Imagine the following scenario. You're led down a long, narrow hallway into a dark room. There you sit and listen to a recording of a Franz Kafka short story, followed by a memory test on what you've just heard. You finish the test and step back into the corridor. But while you are listening to Kafka, a team has been hard at work. The corridor was actually made of temporary partitions. Now they've been moved to create a wide open space. The room has bright green walls. A single light bulb hangs from the ceiling, illuminating a bright red chair. And sitting in the chair is your best friend, looking solemn. You come out thinking you're going to be heading down the same narrow hallway, and boom, a room where a room isn't supposed to be, and your friend staring at you like a character in a horror film. Would you be surprised? Of course you would. And what would your face look like? Well, you wouldn't look the same as a Chobriand Islander would look in that situation, nor a citizen of ancient Rome. But within our culture, in this time and place, what surprise looks like is well established. There's a perfect example of surprise in that same Friends episode. Ross's roommate Joey rushes into Monica's apartment and discovers two of his best friends trying to kill each other. And his face tells you everything you need to know. Action unit 1 plus 2, eyebrows shooting up, plus action unit 5, eyes going wide, plus action unit 25 plus 26, which is your jaw dropping. If you were very surprised, you'd make the Joey face, right? Wrong. Two German psychologists, Achim Schutzwall and Rainer Reisenstein, created the Kafka scenario and ran 60 people through it. Those 60 rated their feelings of surprise when they opened the door after their session with Kafka at 8.14 on a scale of 1 to 10. They were stunned. And when asked, almost all of them were convinced that surprise was written all over their faces. But it wasn't. Schutzwall and Reisenstein had a video camera in the corner, and they used it to code everyone's expressions in the same way Fugate had coded the Friends episode. In only 5% of the cases did they find wide eyes, shooting eyebrows, and dropped jaws. In 17% of the cases, they found two of those expressions. In the rest, they found some combination of nothing, a little something, and things such as knitted eyebrows that you wouldn't necessarily associate with surprise at all. The participants in all conditions grossly overestimated their surprise expressivity, Schutzwall and Reisenstein wrote. Why? They inferred their likely facial expressions to the surprising event from folk psychological beliefs about emotion-face associations. Folk psychology is the kind of crude psychology we glean from cultural sources, such as sitcoms. But that is not the way things happen in real life. Transparency is a myth, an idea we've picked up from watching too much television and reading too many novels where the hero's jaw dropped with astonishment or eyes went wide with surprise. The two psychologists go on to say, the participants apparently reasoned that since they felt surprised, and since surprise is associated with a characteristic facial display, they must have shown this display. In most cases, this inference was erroneous. I don't think that this mistake, expecting what is happening on the outside to perfectly match what is going on inside, matters with our friends. Part of what it means to get to know someone is to come to understand how idiosyncratic their emotional expressions can be. My father was once in the shower in a vacation cottage that my parents had rented when he heard my mother scream. He came running to find a large young man with a knife to my mother's throat. What did he do? Keep in mind that this is a 70-year-old man, naked and dripping wet. He pointed at the assailant and said in a loud, clear voice, "Get out now!" And the man did. On the inside, my father was terrified. The most precious thing in his life, his beloved wife of half a century, was being held at knife point. But I doubt very much that fear showed on his face. His eyes didn't go wide with terror, and his voice didn't jump an octave. If you knew my father, you would have seen him in other stressful situations, and you would have come to understand that the frightened face, for whatever reason, was simply not part of his repertoire. In crisis, he turned deadly calm. But if you didn't know him, what would you have thought? Would you have concluded that he was cold, unfeeling? When we confront a stranger, we have to substitute an idea, a stereotype, for direct experience. And that stereotype is wrong all too often. By the way, do you know how the Trobianders show surprise? When Crivelli showed up, he had a little Apple iPod, and the islanders gathered around in admiration.
They were approaching me. I was showing them. They was doing... They were, like, freaking out, like, saying, and they were not doing, like...
He mimed a perfect AU 1 plus 2 plus 5.
No, they were...
This is the explanation for the second of the puzzles in Chapter 2 about why computers do a much better job than judges at making bail decisions. The computer cannot see the defendant. Judges can. And it seems logical that that extra bit of information ought to make them better decision makers. Solomon, the New York State judge, could search the face of the person standing in front of him for evidence of mental illness, a glassy-eyed look, a troubled affect, aversion of the eyes. The defendant stands no further than 10 feet in front of him, and Solomon has the chance to get a sense of the person he is evaluating. But all that extra information isn't actually useful. Surprised people don't necessarily look surprised. People who have emotional problems don't always look like they have emotional problems. Some years ago, there was a famous case in Texas in which a young man named Patrick Dale Walker put a gun to his ex-girlfriend's head, only to have the gun jam as he pulled the trigger. The judge in his case set bail at $1 million, then lowered it to $25,000 after Walker had spent 4 days in jail on the grounds that this was long enough for him to cool off. Walker, the judge explained later, had nothing on his record, not even a traffic ticket. He was polite. He was a real low-key, mild-mannered young man. The kid, from what I understand, is a real smart kid. He was valedictorian of his class. He graduated from college. This was supposedly his first girlfriend. Most importantly, according to the judge, Walker showed remorse. The judge thought Walker was transparent. But what does showed remorse mean? Did he put on a sad face, cast his eyes down, and lower his head the way he had seen people show remorse on 1,000 television shows? And why do we think that if someone puts on a sad face, casts their eyes down, and lowers their head, then some kind of sea change has taken place in their heart? Life is not friends. Seeing Walker didn't help the judge. It allowed him to explain away the simple fact that Walker had put a gun to his girlfriend's head and failed to kill her only because the gun misfired. 4 months later, while out on bail, Walker shot his girlfriend dead. Kleinberg and his team write, "Whatever these unobserved variables are that cause judges to deviate from the predictions, whether internal states such as mood or specific features of the case that are salient and overweighted, such as the defendant's appearance, they are not a source of private information so much as a source of mispredictions. The unobservables create noise, not signal." Translation: the advantage that the judge has over the computer isn't actually an advantage. Should we take the Kleinberg study to its logical conclusion? Should we hide the defendant from the judge? Maybe when a woman shows up in a courtroom wearing a niqab, the correct response isn't to dismiss her case. It's to require that everyone wear a veil. For that matter, it is also worth asking whether you should meet the babysitter in person before you hire her, or whether your employer did the right thing in scheduling a face-to-face interview before making you a job offer. But of course, we can't turn our backs on the personal encounter, can we? The world doesn't work if every meaningful transaction is rendered anonymous. I asked Judge Solomon if he would prefer not being able to see the defendant. "There's a part of my brain that says I would prefer that," he said, "because then the hard decisions to put someone in jail would feel less hard. But that's not right. You have a human being taken into custody by the state, and the state has to justify why it's taking liberty away from a human, right?" The transparency problem ends up in the same place as the default to truth problem. Our strategies for dealing with strangers are deeply flawed, but they are also socially necessary. We need the criminal justice system and the hiring process and the selection of babysitters to be human. But the requirement of humanity means that we have to tolerate an enormous amount of error. That is the paradox of talking to strangers. We need to talk to them, but we're terrible at it. And as we'll hear in the next two chapters, we're not always honest with one another about just how terrible at it we are.